all the previous cases that I've been involved with, where the situation is like this here, it's always been a recovery. It's never been a happy ending.
Bring her home.
You will start to question whether a memory is real or false only when that element of memory or that...
Why did his father leave him in a ditch in the middle of nowhere, then lie about it and disappear?
From eye scrapings and evasive nose probings to incisions in the skin, John of God has performed countless unlicensed surgical procedures, seemingly with no anesthesia.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners, part two on Israel Keyes. The man who, well, I don't even need to insult him myself because he does a good enough job being the biggest piece of shit on his own. This sexually motivated serial killer had no victimology. No one was off limits, despite what he will tell you later in this episode. He was also admittedly bisexual, so his sexual crimes involved both men and women. He wasn't a Ted Bundy in the sense of he had a victim type. Ted Bundy went after co-eds with brown hair parted down the middle, for the most part. Israel Keyes was all over the map, though, and often his murders were crimes of opportunity. He would stalk areas more than he did people. He would hide in the woods, stalk park bathrooms, parking lots, cemeteries, anywhere where he could see them, but they couldn't see him. Or where it was perfectly reasonable for a stranger to be in the same remote place as you. And before we get into the story, sources include FBI documents, FBI interrogation tapes, Reddit, True Crime Bullshit by Josh Hallmark, American Predator by Maureen Callahan, a CBS special, and Anchorage Daily News articles. And if you're interested in reading the FBI files, I'm going to upload the most poignant ones to the Patreon, and we'll link the interrogation videos there as well. Okay, so in talking about remote places that Keyes would stalk, I swear to God, park bathrooms have always scared the shit out of me. Park bathrooms and rest areas. I mean, I will check every stall in a rest area before I go into the public bathroom. And even if this public bathroom is in a park in Beverly Hills where I used to walk to. But I always freak out, though, because like even if I don't see feet like below, I always think that someone could be standing on the toilet seat, and that scares the hell out of me. And Israel Keyes has confirmed these terrible nightmares for me. And before we get into this embarrassing excuse for a person, I must give a severe trigger warning. Like I said last episode, I'm going to try and skim over the extra gruesome and heartbreaking details as much as I possibly can. But I've researched this so in depth that I know the details to my core. And so I will try to protect you to the best of my ability, but I may have become a tad more desensitized in terms of, I mean, when I first started researching this, I would have to like stop reading because it was just too much for me. And I'm still so heartbroken for the victims and their families and everyone affected by Keyes. And they all deserve justice and answers to know what happened to their person. But to me, he's become so mundanely pathetic and awful. And I mean that as an insult to him. It's intentional that I say that. Because yes, I am still so incredibly invested in connecting the dots on the immense amount of people that went missing in Israel's orbit. And I'm hoping that if we all put our heads together, maybe someone saw something. Maybe it's one of you. But I just don't want to give him the credit that, fine, I am still really scared of him, but I also just want him to know that I think he's a fucking loser. So like I said, I'm more comfortable with writing about his crimes now, but I will still be withholding unnecessary details in order to keep these victims' integrity and actually their will to live intact, because most of these victims fought like hell and made several escape attempts. Like I said, though, by telling the true story of Keyes' 14-plus year killing spree, I'm hoping to spark a memory in someone, or at the very least, just keep this case on the radar because there's still so much we don't know about Israel Keyes. And I've even put in a few phone calls.
Due to high call volume, you may be required to leave a voicemail.
Please leave your name and your telephone number twice and the brief purpose of your call. Your call will be returned as soon as practical. If you have general questions about Camp Rylea, please use our webpage at oregon.gov/OMD. For individual reservations or for general Camp Rylea billing information, press 1. For scheduling groups of 12 or more, both military and civilian, press 2.
Wait while I transfer your call. Sorry.
First Sergeant Lewis.
Is not available. Record your message at the tone. When you are finished, hang up or press pound for more options.
Hi, Sergeant Lewis. I've called a couple of times and have not been able to receive a call back yet. And I might be reaching the wrong person here, but I chose a different prompt on the automated system this time. And basically, my name is Rachel O'Brien. I'm an investigative journalist, and I was wondering if you guys kept records of former military personnel who trained at Camp Rylea. I also grew up in Warrenton and Astoria, so I know it well. I used to actually hear all the stuff growing up at Camp Rylea. But anyways, I have a specific person I would like to know if was not stationed there but trained there.
But it's not always easy. I've called the military training base in my hometown several times now, and I've not gotten a response. A bad taste in their mouth, perhaps? But I never said his name on the answering machine. I don't know. Because as you know from my last episode, and if you haven't listened to part 1 on Israel Keyes, I suggest you do so that you're caught up to speed. But I mentioned finding him familiar, and so did many of my friends and locals from my hometown. But like I said, confirmation has yet to happen on this wormy monster. Honestly, he's so horrible, it just didn't seem worth it to dig into him because he does a good enough job embarrassing himself, but for old time's sake. So visually watching him nap in the interrogation room videos when he's left alone, his head is barely able to sustain the weight of his movie screen forehead and 1920s French girl flip hairdo. I swear to God, you gotta see one of these. I mean, it literally, he looks like Amelie. You know, I know that him like napping and yawning should upset me, but it actually helped me sleep a little better at night, knowing that he could have had a better chance of joining a cabaret than anything else in life. Well, besides the unspeakable crimes he committed, but I just want him to know, and Israel, I hope this resonates to the pits of hell, you look like a pussy, my friend. And you know what? You knew that. You knew you were a blip on the radar in life, and you were so pathetic that you found the only way you could feel important, and that was to terrorize people. But trust me, those people saw right through your desperate attempt to feel important. They knew they were better than you. Even as you thought you were playing God, they knew you were fucking pathetic. God, that felt good. Woo, I'm normally very unconfrontational, and I know I'm not talking directly to him, but I am hoping he hears it somehow. But wow, that felt good. Another completely unsettling thing that Israel does in the interrogation room that was pointed out in Maureen Callahan's brilliantly researched and written book, American Predator, which much of this research came from, was that during retellings of his crimes, certain ones, he would, quote, become physically excited, bobbing his knees, jangling his shackles, and rubbing against his armchair so hard he scraped a layer of wood clean off. Maureen goes on to write, quote, this would become another tell, his signature expression of sexual excitement, a substitute, essentially, for masturbation. It would be the way the investigators knew there was much truth to his story. Stories, end quote. Now, while listening to the hours of FBI tapes, and you'll notice it in some clips that I have pulled for this episode, I can hear, and I'm pretty sure you will be able to, hear him doing this very thing, and it's revolting. sorry to do this to you guys, but we're in this together. And if I had to know about this, well, you have to too. And you will not be able to get it out of your head when you start to notice it in the clips. Like, say, maybe right now.
I mean, out where I was, fires were nothing. It's like, I start fires, you know, pretty much every time I go out to camp. Generally, I wouldn't start the whole forest on fire. That was never my intention. I'm kind of outdoorsy person, so I actually enjoy the forest. But I would, you know, if I found like old buildings and stuff that I thought I could get away with burning without anyone worrying too much about it, that's almost like a public service.
Doing them a favor. So that's something you've done. Did you ever use fire to cover up a crime or something?
Well, yeah.
Like Alita. Burglar.
Oh. That was just...
What was it that needed to be
burned? That place on
earth. Burn houses up with bodies in them?
I would let them come to me. Just remote area. You know,
Kind of like,
go to a remote area that's not anywhere near where you live, but that other people go to as well. You might not get exactly what you're... There's not as much to choose from, in a manner of speaking, but there's also no witnesses, really. There's nobody else around, so... And then when they disappear, a lot of times... Nobody's really surprised. That happens all the time. It always surprises me. You know, like some situations you read about in the paper, like so-and-so disappeared, presumed boating accident, for example. And they find their boat. You don't know what really happened to that person.
And I think we already talked about this, but even though you were never questioned by law enforcement about why you were ever in any of these places or anything.
Well, like I said, casually.
By law enforcement?
Yeah.
Like they would see you at a trailhead and just...
Right.
Small talk with you.
Right, yeah.
Are you here to fish? Are you here to hike? Those kind of things.
Right.
Let me see your fishing license.
Right, and I usually had...
Everything?
Yeah, I always had all that stuff. Honestly, a lot of times, that's what I was doing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for as far back as I can remember. You know, that's where I get a lot of the ideas. Either fishing or out hunting. Yeah, I don't know, that was always the most comfortable scenario for me, because it's a win-win situation. You're out hunting or fishing, and if the opportunity comes up, then take it. If it doesn't, it's not like it's... you're out anything.
Horrifying, right? And let us remember that religion may or may not have played a role in who Israel Keyes became, as he is oddly reliable and unreliable at the same time, with his truths and lies. But what we do know is that at one point, he said his upbringing had nothing to do with it. But later, in FBI interrogation interviews, explicitly stated that religion did have to do with who he became. Perhaps this was because his parents ping-ponged between religions, or maybe more poignant, was it because they chose religions doused in shame? In Israel's case, a major reason for their move from Washington to Maupin, Oregon, which is where Israel committed his first admitted rape, yet alludes to having sex with someone against their will before... I don't know what the difference is, but my uneducated guess is that the victim in Maupin, I don't know, he admitted to tying her up, but he also admits to her outsmarting him. So I don't know. I think it might be the murderous force he inflicted upon her that he's considering is like more rape. And he had the intention to kill her, while maybe the others were still categorically rape, but the end goal which is disgusting to even say, was just rape, not torturous rape that ended in murder. I don't know. I don't even know why I'm trying to make sense of him. But again, these terms and making sense of him is just mind-boggling, and all rape is torture, frankly. But if we are to try and understand the monstrous mind of Israel Keyes, we have to listen to his words, dissect them, and find the truths and clues hidden in them. Because although this piece of shit is an absolute corner of your nose zit pain to endure, his FBI interviews and maps and computer searches the FBI have put together and released to the public could help solve multiple missing person cases. But quickly back to religion for a second. Perhaps his sister Autumn Rose's 2011, yes, 2011, 1 year before he was arrested for Samantha Koenig's murder and was exposed to authorities as a serial killer, his sister was busy typing away about the shame she felt about, clutching pearls here, waiting with bated breath, the time she spent doing downright dirty deeds, committing the sin of listening to contemporary Christian music. But no, her deals with the devil didn't end there. She also, well, I'll just read part of her religious testimony in her words. And I'm not going to read all of it because this 6 pages of shame mongering is too much. And while I'm not trying to make fun of her or her beliefs, you know, I come from a self-deprecating comedic background, and I only hope that if she ever hears this, she knows that she was a good gosh darn kid and that contemporary Christian music was fine, more than fine. Okay, this is what she says. Dear friends, my testimony by Autumn Rose Trudeau Keyes. I believe the Lord has laid it on my heart to give an account of his dealings with me. It will be a short account, Lord willing. It's not a short account, Rosie. Can I call you Rosie? It's a single-spaced, 6-page long account, for which, like I said, guys, I'm only going to read some highlights. And Autumn Rose, if you ever hear this, I'm not making fun of you. I bet you are lovely, and I want you to know you were a good kid, still are. Anywho, she says, I marvel at the mercy God has had on me all these years up to this point, when I've carelessly been about my own business, walking in the lust of my own heart. Then there's some scripture, I'm not reading that. Around the age of 11 and 12, my heart turned in rebellion toward my parents. My two older sisters and I were in kind of a revolt against them. We had friends they did not like. We secretly listened to music they forbade. And we got away with as much as we could. My conviction from early on was, quote, of course I'm Christian. No one ever questioned me that I can remember. At 13, I fell into the grievous sin that my parents did not know about. I began to doubt God's existence, and I planned to leave my family as soon as possible and dive headfirst into sin. I've thanked God many times for my earthly father, who was a strict man. When my sins came to light by God's mercy, he pulled me away from my circumstances and moved the family to an Amish community. Things must have looked patched up. After some time, we had a new life. We had friends in the community, and we definitely looked religious. There was less tension with my parents, yet not a closeness or submission. My father passed away when I was 18. I regretted so much my rebellion and the cold distance I had had toward my father. 1 year later, my sister and I were talked into going to a week-long charity Bible school. I didn't want to go, and I didn't know what it would be like. It was there that I experienced what I believed with all my heart, according to the Bible, to have been false conversion. For the first couple days, I was agreeing with and enjoying the wonderful preaching. I was, as I remember, unshaken until my sister responded to an altar call. I began to be troubled that she was troubled. The next thing I knew, my sister came out from counseling and everyone was rejoicing and singing and saying she was saved. I felt like there was something I'd missed. I felt like I was on the outside of a kingdom and suddenly started to bawl. I was taken back to counseling, but I don't remember what was said. I just remember wanting to talk to my sister and find out how she got saved. I finally got the opportunity late that night. She told me something about trusting in Jesus' sacrifice. I think at that moment, I just closed my eyes and pictured Christ and thought, That was all I needed to do, just trust that he'd saved me. So that is what I did. I was in all of my own strength and self-righteousness. What a grief to have been called by Christ's name falsely. The fruit of my life may have looked good on the outside, but it was not. I had not the freedom from sin, because the axe had not been laid to the root of the tree. This is too much. The whole while I was in sin, but convinced I was born again, saved, and following God. Then several years down the road, I was getting really discontent, and I was a grief to my mother, which she told me. I'm sure she did. I reformed again, and I submitted to her, being convicted by a basic youth seminar. Soon I began to allow more sin into my life that I knew was sin, but I let my conscience become seared. I would watch what I considered to be good movies. Yeah, that's right, Autumn. Free Willy? Off the table. Kindergarten Cop? Hell no. Fine, I chose those because they were filmed in Astoria, my hometown, and I was in kindergarten when Kindergarten Cop filmed at my school, but they cut my scene. Worst mistake of Ivan Reitman's directorial career, rumor has it. Then Autumn goes on to say, I started struggling with impure thoughts and sins. I started listening to contemporary Christian music. Holy shit! You gotta be kidding me. You might as well have just said you took your top off at a Jars of Clay concert, Autumn. Come on. Now, I can see how this could have been a slippery slope for you. Because when I went to Jars of Clay on Spotify Radio, Jars of Clay Spotify Radio, evil certainly trickled in because bands like Gin Blossoms and Goo Goo Dolls started automatically playing on the Lord's contemporary channel, which I know was already a slippery slope of sin. Okay, I'm almost done, guys. You gotta let me have some joy before we get super dark. So then she says, I would confess these sins sometimes and seek to stop, but things got worse, and what I watched got worse. I was in this state when, praise the Lord, I became utterly condemned. In November 2009, we met the evangelists who traveled around in an RV preaching and seeking the Lord. They came and stayed in our driveway, and we began to get some preaching, mostly just the scriptures being quoted. I could see that God was with them and that they were not like me, in that serving the Lord was their delight. Their lives were much more in conviction than what they preach. I remember one night after they had preached, I confessed I was either backslidden or never saved at all. And they just encouraged me to seek the Lord. I went to my room and I started to read the fearful warnings of Hebrews. And because I saw no way that I could have been saved in 2003, I began to believe that I was now like Esau, I think, and could not repent. I was so tormented by these thoughts most of the night, and I almost went to tell them to stop praying for me because I could hear their prayer meeting outside. Because I could not be saved anymore. I didn't, and I tried to find some way out. And then there's three pages of her saying she's an unsavable peasant. And then she hates herself some more. Then two pages back and forth of I'm saved and I'm not saved. I'm a fraud. These aren't her words. I'm just summarizing scripture. And then she says, basically, the night and the next day, I experienced the presence of Jesus, where I had been filled with such pain and grief, knowing I was utterly separated from God. And now he sent me so much love and nearness that my heart ached, and I asked him to hold some back. Too much love. Now, yeah, like literally, she's now feeling shame for feeling God's love. The shame spiral has to stop, my friend. Then she meets some more people from her church and says it was very intense. And then she's baptized again and sin free. But, I mean, by the skin of her teeth, because thank God she was this close to listening to Creed. Okay, one last funny anecdote, because it's going to get dark. I made a joke to my best friend the other day about Creed, and all of a sudden, as the words came out of my mouth, I had a jolt of shock, and I remembered that as a 15-year-old, where I should have been trying to be cool, you know, I was old enough to give a shit, but clearly not. I did a young choreographer's ballet routine competition with arms wide open, and it was a fever dream I didn't need to relive. Okay, I'm getting down to the wire, only about 1 month before my wedding, and maybe I'm a little stressed. And what's been helping me is microdosing my Lumi gummies. Okay, I've said this before. I've always been like a little freaked out by THC, or I just kind of was like, I don't know. I needed someone to hold my hand and guide me. And Lumi microdosing has done just that. When I say I seriously sleep like a baby, and right before I go to sleep, like, I wouldn't say that I feel, it's not like I feel high or anything. I just feel so calm and just so proud of myself for the day and, like, just ready to cozy up and just have the best night sleep. Like, I would even recommend this to my mom, who's even a bigger wuss than me. I mean, they are truly life-changing. Microdose is available nationwide. To learn more about microdosing THC, just do a quick search online or go to microdose.com and use code SINNERS to get free shipping and 30% off your first order. Links can be found in the show description, but again, that's microdose.com, code SINNERS. My point in sharing her testimony is that it shows you the immense shame the Keys kids lived under. Yet Israel was the only one to become a monster as a result of that shame. Nature or nurture? Probably a combo of both. But again, amongst his 9 siblings, he's the only one to become a terrible, horrible... he's not even a human. And I don't think Israel experienced the most shame in the family either. But a few moments may have triggered him. Part of the reason the family moved to Oregon was a ploy by his parents to get him away from his Washington girlfriend, the neighbor girl, who he would go on to become engaged to, then cheat on, and then break up with. But his parents did not approve of him dating and wanted to get him far away from that sin fest, apparently, even though this girl was also extremely religious and a virgin. But in my completely unprofessional opinion, it seems Key's relationship with his mom was maybe even more triggering. It was weird and unhealthy. You see, this is never good. He was kind of thrust into the role of a pseudo-partner to his mom. He basically kind of acted like her partner or like father figure to his siblings when his dad was away, and his mom relied on him for these manly, maybe even emotional tasks. And Israel was required to build the family's various dwellings, if you can even call them that, and parent his siblings so his father and his mother could spend their time and energy searching for a new holy land or psychotic group to join. It just sets the groundwork for an angry young man wanting control of his life, and in Israel's case, control of others' lives. In the last episode, I ended on Israel abducting Samantha Koenig from her coffee stand in Alaska. Samantha being his alleged last victim. And I only say alleged because he was on the run, known to be in various states from the time she was murdered to the time he was arrested for weeks. So I'm not comfortable saying she was for sure his last victim. The FBI says that they believe there are at least 11 victims. But many, if not most, agree there are probably many more. Which is why I was going to try and not do a fourth episode, but I kind of feel too invested to not. And I hope you all are on the same page, because many of the places that Keys frequented have missing people that could be tied to Keys, and maybe they're places that you've lived, and a story might resonate with you and trigger a memory or an unsettling encounter or a story from a friend. And I think you guys are like me and want to learn more about him, so fingers crossed you're into 4 parts. And before we get into the rest of Samantha's story, the preceding episodes will bounce around in timeline because as more information came out, the further back investigators went, as they learned that Israel Keys didn't just murder Samantha Koenig. He had been on the prowl, horrifyingly stalking, taking, and disposing of people of all races, genders, class, situation in life, for at least 14 years. But the odds are much more heartbreakingly earlier. More on that next episode. So where we left off last episode, Samantha Koenig was forcefully taken by Keys, taken in his truck. She was set to be picked up by her boyfriend of around a year, not long after she disappeared, who arrived at Common Grounds around 8:30, literally minutes after she was taken. He realized she wasn't there and that the coffee stand had already been locked up. So he tried calling her and calling her. No answer. Unsure of what to do, he went back to the house that he shared with Samantha and her father, James. Immediately, James knew something was wrong. Both of them did. And that was confirmed when, a few hours after the boyfriend returned to the house, he received a text message from Samantha's phone that they both agreed did not sound like Samantha. It said, quote, "F you, asshole. I know what you did. I'm going to spend a couple of days with friends. Need time to think, plan. Acting weird. Let my dad know." Both James and her boyfriend are immediately suspicious. And then about 20 minutes later at 11:50, just a single text comes in from her phone saying, "Fuck you." Meanwhile, they were able to get a hold of the common grounds owner, who was able to check the surveillance footage remotely. And what they saw was terrifying. And meanwhile, Samantha's nightmare had just begun. Initially, both James and her boyfriend were persons of interest. Her boyfriend, because they had been fighting that day, and because when investigators spoke to him, he said he saw a man in a ski mask going through their car at about 3 a.m. that night. And James, her dad, was initially a person of interest because it was rumored that he was involved in the drug trade in the area and moved about $60,000 worth of pot, but may have stolen half of it. And additionally, investigators thought it was odd that he wouldn't let them into his house the first time because he had a grow operation in there, but also because he set up a fund within 48 hours of her going missing, collecting money for her search and rescue, and then he used some of it on himself, but he did an interview with the news, and he said that he had to use some of it to keep his house running while he was searching for his daughter. This initial distraction caused a bit of time that maybe could have been focused on possible stranger abduction, but, I mean, the cops always look at the people closest to them. I don't think they made a mistake. I think they didn't have any clues, really. But sadly, Samantha would be dead within hours of her abduction. Continuing her nightmare that night, Keys made her stay down in the truck so she wouldn't be seen. And I wonder what she must have been thinking. I wonder if she believed him when he told her that he only kidnapped her for ransom money, and if she cooperated, he would return her to her family. Hours later, he finally pulled up to his home he shared with Kimberly around midnight. And the neighborhood was still fairly awake, maybe even Kimberly was, so Keys told Samantha to shut up and he would be back. He closed the door of the truck, it went dark, and then he walked toward the house. According to American Predator, where she quotes Keys in one of the interrogation transcripts or tapes, which she took the time to write down, I in fact did not time code it to transcribe myself, so thank you, Maureen. This is how Keys describes what happened next. He says, "What was I thinking? Well, because the shed was already set up. I had two heaters going in there, and I had a big tarp, like a 9x12 tarp, laid out on the floor. And there was a radio in there and stuff. And so, yeah, I guess it was probably between 1 and 2 a.m. that I finally got the nerve to, like, get her out of the truck and walk her over to the... I had her blindfolded then because, you know, I was telling her, like, don't try to see anything because we've got to get this thing worked out." And so now Samantha's inside the shed, and Keys continues. "I was telling her, I'll make you comfortable. You just sit here. But I'm going to have this police scanner on me, so if I hear reports of screaming from this neighborhood or anything, any disturbance from over here, I'm going to be back here before the cops get here." He then turned on heavy metal on full blast to make any noises that could come from the shed be drowned out, which that in of itself is terrifying. I actually don't mind metal music, and I enjoy running to Rob Zombie and, like, System of a Down, but can you imagine already in the worst moment of your life, the worst situation, to hear some guys screaming about the devil? I don't know why that scares me so much. Like, you're already alone, tied up in this shed, you've been abducted, like, and now you have to listen to, God, if it was Marilyn Manson, that is just cruel. So anyways, Keys continues on in the interrogation. He says, "You know, she was very cooperative. She didn't seem like she was going to try anything. I gave her like a 5-gallon bucket for her to pee in." Oh, you're so nice. Oh, God, Israel. Ugh. "For her to pee in, and then I dumped that out onto the trailer and then stuck it back in the shed so she'd have something to sit on.
And then I took a piece of rope and put it around her neck and screwed it to the wall on both sides. And I think I changed her. In Maureen's book, she says it was unclear if he said chained, like chained her up, or changed her, like changed her clothes. It's unclear. Then he says, I moved her hands so that they were in front of her so she could smoke and stuff. And yeah, I just told her to chill out. Cool, man. Yeah, cool. Just tell her to chill. He then forces her to give him her home address so that he could retrieve her debit card. And this is when Samantha's boyfriend encountered a masked man getting into their car in the middle of the night, like at 3 a.m., which detectives found very strange when the boyfriend told them the story, but the story was true. Keith said that I took Kimberly's car, I parked 3 or 4 blocks away from where Samantha's truck was, and I walked over there, and I used the key to open the door, and the car was right where she said it would be, and I was just locking up the truck, and some guy came out and obviously knew something was up right away. And the only reason the boyfriend didn't confront Israel Keys is because Keys brandished a knife, and so the boyfriend ran back in the house to get help. I hate this part so much. So after that, Keys returns home nonchalantly and pours himself a glass of wine. And he insinuated to FBI agents that Kimberly still had no idea what was going on. She was sleeping soundly, and I truly believe she was, which is just so, I can't even imagine being her. And the next part, major trigger warning. So Keys then drank his wine, returned to the shed, where he raped Samantha twice, and then strangled her to death, and stabbed her once above the left shoulder blade. In his FBI interviews, I'm not going to play it, he will barely say the words of when he, like, sexually assaults someone, but he would said to the cops that it took a while, like at least 2 songs or 2 or 3 songs, which it doesn't even seem like that long. I seriously cannot get enough of Thrive Cosmetics. I even bought some for my mom for Mother's Day, so hopefully she doesn't listen to this. I think that true crime scares her, so she probably isn't. But I seriously cannot get enough. Their Defying Gravity Eye Lifting Cream is everything to me. I'm like more prone to crow's feet than any other like wrinkles or age, you know, age showing. But I swear, Thrive's Gravity Eye Lifting Cream instantly lifts, tightens, and brightens my skin around my eyes with line smoothing hydration. It softens, it soothes, and it deeply moisturizes my skin while instantly reducing dark circles and puffiness. It fights signs of stress, aging, and dullness. It's like beauty sleep in a bottle. I'm also obsessed with their overnight mask, overnight sensation. Trust me, it's a sensation. You wake up looking brighter, younger. I mean, I can't say enough about Thrive Cosmetics. Thrive Cosmetics are high-performance beauty and skincare products made with clean, skin-loving ingredients. And Cause is in the name for a reason, because every purchase supports organizations that help women thrive. One of my favorites is this program where it's helping women transition from the military into like real life. And so Thrive donates beauty products and, you know, whatever to make them feel their best and confident when they enter their new life. I just think that's so cool. It makes me so happy. And, you know, it's a brand I really stand behind, not only because it works amazingly, but because they're doing good. And I love their makeup too. Their Liquid Lash Extensions Mascara is essentially that. I mean, like, why would you ever go get extensions when you can just put this mascara on? It is a best-selling product. It has more than 15,000 five-star reviews. It's ultra-lengthening, eye-opening mascara, and it lasts all day without clumping, smudging, or flaking. And like I said, it mimics the look of lash extensions without damaging glue or expensive salon prices. You don't need that. You just wear this mascara, and it's like, boop! You look so, like, it's like Bambi eyes. I just love Thrive Cosmetics. And now is a great time to try Thrive Cosmetics for yourself. Right now, you can get 15% off your first order when you visit thrivecosmetics.com/sinners. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS.com/sinners for 15% off your first order. Keys then as if he had just returned from taking out the trash or something, went inside his home, packed for a pre-planned cruise to New Orleans, woke up his daughter to get ready, and then the two got in a cab and left for the 2-week-long trip. A cruise? Well, Samantha was in the shed and Kimberly left behind in the house. I can't even wrap my head around that. I just can't, for two reasons. What if Kimberly needed like a garden tool or something from the shed? And also, how unbelievably gut-wrenching to find out a teenager your boyfriend had just raped and murdered was just feet from you and you had no idea. But this is how Keys recounts it to the FBI. So they're obviously kind of like, you went on a cruise afterwards? And he, yeah, I was running late. And then he laughs. And then the detective says, where was Samantha when you left in the cab? She was in the shed. Was she alive? Keys. Yeah, I might save that story for later. Then the story gets even worse. Keys returned to Anchorage on February 17th, 2012. He removed Samantha's body from a cupboard, put makeup on her frozen, weeks-long dead face, and then another trigger warning, sewed her eyes open with fishing line, and then took a photo of her holding a newspaper to show proof of date and, I guess for him, hopefully, thought proof of life. He then typed up a ransom note and included that photo before he posted it in a park under a memorial flyer of a dog named Albert, before using Samantha's phone to text her boyfriend. So on February 24th, 23 days after Samantha's abduction, her boyfriend received a text message on his phone. Just said, quote, Connor Park, sign under, pick up Albert. Ain't she pretty? End quote. Immediately, James, her father, contacted the investigators. And under the sign at Connor's Park, they found a letter and a photo of Samantha in a plastic bag and the letter demanding $30,000. However, on Key's end, FBI and her family completely unaware. Though some investigators thought she very well could have been dead in the photo, and they were right. Because in the days that followed, Keys dismembered Samantha's body and drove out to Manaskuka Lake, where he cut a hole in the ice and he put her body in the frozen lake. But without that information, they had to keep trying. The FBI deposited money into Samantha's account, and then ATM transactions began happening daily, and the FBI used this to track the suspect's movements. A tip even came in from a local news channel that someone was leaving comments on news boards by the name of Israel. He's kind of dumb. So, like I said, money started getting withdrawn daily, first several times in Alaska, and then in the lower 48, which really surprised them. It happened in Arizona, then New Mexico, and then Texas. In one of the ATM footage videos, one of them noticed a white Ford Focus parked in the distance. Could that have been the assailant's car? So they went with it. And the last ATM, which that video was taken off of Highway 59. So the FBI worked with local investigators and the Texas Rangers and decided they should be staking out hotels off of Highway 59. And wouldn't you know it, parked at a Quality Inn located right off of the highway was a white Ford Focus. They looked inside the car and they saw little girl's clothes, and they also noticed that the car was a rental with Texas license plates. So they monitored the hotel, and then a white male steps down to the car, loads it up, and then takes off. So they trail him. And at first they weren't finding a reason to pull him over, but they just kept hoping. And then when he went 2 miles over the speed limit, the highway patrolman pulled him over. When the highway patrolman approached the car, the man asked where Keys was from. And Keys replied, Alaska. Bingo. He then asked him for his ID. The name? Israel Keys. An FBI agent arrived within minutes and was handed the Alaska driver's license with Israel's name on it. Keyes began sweating, like noticeably, profusely sweating. And he started giving way too many details, like, I flew into Las Vegas and then I'm here in Texas staying with my brother for my sister's wedding. And just, they didn't ask that much information. And they said he seemed visibly very nervous. They had their man. But what they didn't know is that they were about to learn that the man they had in custody was one of the worst monsters in recent history. Israel had been pulled over for an hour before all necessary law enforcement arrived. And when they did, they began a search of his car. The cash, and I use that term to throw it in Israel's face, included a treasure trove of evidence pointing to the fact that Iz, as he sometimes liked to be called, oh God, was no longer in control of his life, his narrative, and Iz had a lot of explaining to do. The officers began a search of his car. And are you ready to hear what was in it? So the list of items were detailed in American Predator and included, quote, in addition to the highlighted maps of California, Arizona, and New Mexico, on the front passenger seat they found one can of AMP energy drink open, one set of school photos of a child, one pair of sneakers, white, one ATM receipt, under driver's side floor mat reading debit not available, Sony digital camera containing 200 plus photos of a wedding, one new gray shirt with store tags, packaging Winchester brand amber tinted sunglasses, no packaging, one t-shirt with one sleeve cut off, dark gray fleece, Columbia jacket, several Walmart bags, rolls of cash in denominations of 5 and 10. In the back seat, they also found Walmart receipt stamped Lufkin, Texas, 4:10 a.m., 3/12/2012, one sandwich, one energy drink, one pair of black sunglasses, one partial gallon of water, laundry detergent, one pink backpack in the trunk, one green backpack, one gray DVD case containing pornographic images of a black female, pornographic DVDs, including transgender pornography, Alaska Airlines flight confirmation of Israel Keyes and daughter to depart Anchorage on 3/6/2012, arriving Seattle, Washington, 5:54 a.m., departing Seattle, 3:30 p.m., arriving Las Vegas, 5:56 p.m., bottles of alcohol still chilled in Walmart bags, gray fleece jacket, gray hooded sweatshirt. In the pockets of the gray fleece, they found a gray cloth mask in the front pocket, gloves in another pocket, and then one laptop, one black Samsung cell phone, slider type, battery and SIM card removed, a toiletry kit, one handgun, one pair of binoculars, one black ski mask, and one headlamp. And the detectives that have been working so hard on this, one of them just wanted to do the honors, and he said, hook him up. And now that Keyes was under arrest, they searched his wallet. And guess what they found? Samantha Koenig's driver's license. He was caught. His reign of terror over. In his death, I love picturing Israel Keyes maybe rolling over in his grave, or like maybe he had to meet someone as evil as him in hell, and that guy is, you know, made Israel his target or whatever. Who knows? Because no one is forgetting what Israel did. And no one is going to rest until all of his victims have justice. And old Izzy boy can't giggle his way out of this anymore. Well, that's all for today. Thank you guys so much for listening. And if you're enjoying the show, the best thing to do is leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps to grow the show and it really helps my self-esteem. And next week, we will discuss the other two known victims that Keyes admitted to. And then the following week, well, and we're also going to discuss two victims that I think he killed that is just heartbreaking. And then in part 4, we are going to go into the possible other ways he abducted people. For example, running them off the road. There's a lot of evidence that he could be linked to some very major, major cases. And I truly think that some of the ones that we're going to discuss in part 4 are, I'm not going to give a percentage on how likely, but I'll let you guys decide. I've also put a message out to a woman who narrowly escaped an attack by Israel Keyes. I'm hoping to speak to her and you guys could hear that interview, but we shall see. All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening. Bye.
Stalking through the woods and see somebody in the woods, they don't see you. You sit there and watch them for a while. And I can remember doing that from time I was like 13 or 14 years old.